Good evening, everyone. V'lachol ha'mazinim. This is the first part of our series for this year entitled Great Decisions. And when I thought we would look through a variety of the momentous decisions that the Jewish people had to make during the 20th century. And we'll be able to explore the different sides, what was right or wrong, and even the tantalizing what if. This is part one, the Uganda Plan, we're sponsored this year again by Becky Navi Katz, Ilan Ishmas Yonab and Rab Aryeh Leib. It was the most controversial, most divisive dispute in the first decade of the Zionist movement, which itself was a revolution in the Jewish world. This particular decision pitted relatives and friends against each other, and it threatened to overwhelm and crush the nascent attempt to find a homeland and a refuge for the Jewish people. This was the Uganda Plan that arose suddenly, was sprung on the delegates to the 6th Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland in August 1903, and created a firestorm. It became, in effect, a referendum on Theodor Herzl, who introduced it, who pushed for it, who saw it through, and then was unsuccessful at implementing it. But what would possess Herzl, who had electrified much of the Jewish world and horrified the rest with Zionism, Zionism being the restoration of the Jewish people to a legally secured and publicly recognized homeland in the land of Israel, what would possess him to propose that the Jewish people exchange the land of Israel for Uganda? Was that in fact his proposal? Let's dispel two myths. First, it was not Uganda. Something has to be clarified right away. It was called the Uganda proposal. Herzl at one time called it the Nairobi proposal, or better, was the East Africa plan, because the actual territory that was discussed was not in what is today Uganda, but what is today Kenya, or Kenya, some people say. The whole territory was then known as British East Africa or Uganda, but it's delineated as Kenya, land along the coast and towards the southern part of Kenya heading towards Uganda. Uganda is landlocked. This region included coastal lands as well as interior terrain, even though, truth be told, the precise area was never completely spelled out as the opposition succeeded in shelving it. The second myth was that the vote was not over a homeland. The vote at the Zionist conference was actually whether the Zionist organization should send an investigatory commission to investigate the feasibility of establishing a temporary homeland, a refuge for the Jewish people in British Kenya. Herzl certainly never meant or never envisioned Uganda as a permanent replacement for Israel. So what actually happened? This year, going high-tech, I'm going to try to spice up each lecture with a short clip introducing the area, putting us in the framework of the people of the era and the decisions that were being made, given to me by the Destiny Foundation, Rabbi Beryl Wein's Destiny Foundation, and with their permission, I now show it. If someone could hit the lights, please. You like the screen?
Why is Jewish identity in the modern age? How does one respond to all this? We can remain Jews, but we can do other things as well. We can go out of the ghetto physically and psychologically and enter the world. Re-enter history. How do you do that? Well, Zionism was one option.
Zionism, the longing to return to the land of Israel, had been on the lips of Jews ever since the destruction of the Temple in Jerusalem and the exile of the Jews from their homeland by the Romans in 70 CE.
It's picking it up.
Over 1,800 years later, in Vienna, journalist Theodor Herzl, an assimilated Jew, unleashed his Zionist dream of a Jewish settlement in the land of Israel.
What Herzl was looking for was Zionism, as he saw, to solve the problem of the Jews and have Semitism.
A bald and the false accusation of treason levels against the one Jewish officer in the French general staff, Alfred Dreyfus, Herzl was motivated to find a solution. He considered several options.
Herzl is searching for answers. Just to give you an idea how removed he was from things Jewish, he writes in his diaries, "Let's look for some solution that will satisfy us all. Perhaps mass conversion. A major pageant. The Jews, the prominent Jews, will march up to the major cathedral in Vienna and baptize. No Jews, no anti-Semitism." He quickly dismissed that.
Ultimately, Herzl focused his efforts on creating a homeland for the Jews and started a chain of events that continues to this day.
Zionism says, we want to be like other peoples. There's a naivete to it, of course, that once we have our normal state, we can live, quote, normal lives, then anti-Semitism disappears.
Herzl tirelessly navigated the political wills and interests of the Jewish leaders, secular and religious, which opposed him. He traveled the world in an effort to enlist the agreement of the great powers in achieving his Zionist goal. In London, concerned with the large wave of Jewish immigration to England, a royal commission of the British Parliament assured him that England would favor a Jewish colony, not in the Holy Land, but in East African Uganda. When the Sixth Zionist Congress convened in Basel in August 1903, the Uganda proposal, supported by Herzl, was the dominant issue. It provoked a firestorm of protest, led mainly by the Eastern European Zionist leaders, Chaim Weizmann and Menachem Yushishkin. By 1904, it was apparent that Zionism stood for the Jewish people's return to the land of Israel and no place else. Still, other Zionists brought their own visions to bear. Asher Ginsberg and his cultural Zionism. Aharon David Gordon and his belief in the holiness of the physical labor movement. And Joseph Berdichevsky with his negation of the exile and rejection of past Jewish tradition. Eventually, Chaim Weizmann, who was to become the first president of the State of Israel, and Nachum Sokolow led the Zionist movement.
Herzl rallied the masses of Eastern Europe, who obviously were facing traditional anti-Semitism. He got short shrift, unfortunately, from the Jews of Western Europe. Their whole lifestyle was predicated on acceptance within Berlin, Paris, London. The famous slogan of the reformers, "Berlin is our Zion." They were very assimilated, some intermarried, of course. Western Jewry, which had been living in these countries for generations and had received the vote, were wedded to a good lifestyle where they would be accepted, where their loyalty would not be challenged, and they could practice privately whatever Judaism they wished. Zionism was a direct challenge to the idea of acculturation of Israel.
Okay. Lights, please. One thing should be clear by now. They had very impressive beards back then. So we've discussed in the past Herzl's odyssey. He was born in 1860, raised in Budapest, right next to the Dohany Street Synagogue. Celebrated his bar mitzvah there, but was completely assimilated into European society. He became a fairly well-known journalist and playwright in Vienna. And he once wrote that the ideal solution to the Jewish problem in Europe, the persistent persecution and denial of rights, is complete assimilation, even conversion and disappearance into the general society. It was only in the 1890s that Herzl became obsessed with the Jewish future, and the trial and conviction of Alfred Dreyfus convinced him that the Jews had no future in Europe. This vulgar Jew hatred obviously fabricated charges accompanied by a show trial, conviction, public humiliation, exile, incarceration had occurred not in Poland or Russia where you could have expected it, but in sophisticated, enlightened France. If the European elite had such contempt for Jews, the only possibility for Jewish normalcy would be an independent Jewish state far from Europe, although built in a European socialist style, with the land of Israel being the ideal place. No matter how civilized countries pretended to be, their hatred of Jews apparently was irrational and implacable. In 1896, Herzl published Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, in which he outlined the framework for a Jewish state, almost completely unaware of the Chovei Tzion, who had been settling the land of Israel for 15 years, as well as the earlier proto-Zionist works of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, Tzvi Kalischer, Moses Hess, Leon Pinsker, and others. But his book created a storm. He was already well known in the journalistic world, and he immediately began attempting to solicit support for his idea by meeting with the leading political figures of the day, as well as Jews. Not all Jews took kindly to his ideas or to him. It was religious opposition. They saw Herzl as a rebel against Torah. It was reform opposition. They had already renounced the notion of Jewish nationhood and that of the assimilated as well. A year and a half after the publication of Der Judenstaat, Herzl organized the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. It was moved from Munich, its original location, because of the opposition of the Orthodox and the Reform there. There, in 1896, the Basel program was adopted. In a nutshell, they passed this resolution saying that, I quote, Zionism seeks for the Jewish people a publicly recognized, legally secured homeland in Palestine. You'll note, we'll discuss another time, they didn't say state. Tafasta meruba lo tafasta. They thought small at first, not that it's small, a homeland. Independence would come later. But there the first divisions arose. Religious Jews were always wary of Herzl, especially in light of the deviant movements of the 18th and 19th centuries, reform, enlightenment, emancipation, historical Judaism, etc. But this was not the major dispute. The real confrontation, which was never resolved, and to some extent still exists today, was between what's called on one hand the political Zionists like Herzl, Max Nordau, a doctor who came from a frum Hungarian family, then assimilated, even intermarried, until he was brought back to the Jewish people by the Dreyfus case in Zionism. Nordau also had a very impressive beard. The political Zionists focused on establishing a Jewish homeland through politics, appeals, pressure, lobbying the world governments to grant a homeland to the Jews. They were opposed by the practical Zionists, who were foreshadowed by the Chovei Tzion, led by Moshe Lilienblum and Pinsker and others, modeled on the Chovei Tzion to build facts on the ground, establish settlements, encourage Aliyah. Without facts on the ground, they held, the political Zionists were spinning their wheels, as governments could easily deflect their plans as unrealistic. Echoes of this dispute remain today, of course, between those who want to focus on settlement as the foundation of all good things, especially sovereignty and security, and those who see the essence of the Zionist endeavor as statehood, period, whatever size, whatever territory. Yeah, the political Zionists, the practical Zionists, is a third group that will play a role in the Uganda Plan controversy known as the cultural Zionists, like Achad Ha'am, Asher Tzvi Ginsburg, that perceive the primary goal not as statehood, but as the restoration, the revival of Jewish culture through settlement of the land of Israel. So he saw no religious significance in the land, but rather he saw the land as the cultural heritage, even identity, of the Jewish people. Tzionut Ruchanit was a powerful force then that has almost completely dissipated. It exists in certain segments. You find it part of the Likud, even part of the Labor Party until today. There's another group founded later that will endure until today, the Mizrahi, the religious Zionists, founded in 1902, led by Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Herzl left Basel confident of the future, writing in his diary famous words, were I to sum up the Basel Congress in a word, which I shall guard against pronouncing publicly, it would be this: at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. Maybe in 5 years, certainly in 50, everyone will realize it. Truth is, exactly 50 years later, 50 years and 2 months, the partition plan was adopted at the UN. In the ensuing years, after the conference in 1896, the annual conventions kept the ideas alive, but progress was slow and the divisions proliferated. The same things were discussed year after year, like the Jewish feminist conferences. That was the same thing. So a little tweak here or there, the Second Congress of Financial Body was formed. They decided to focus on outreach to European Jews who were skeptical. The third included Herzl's report of his meeting with the Kaiser, which had accomplished nothing. The fourth, 1900, was held in London to mix things up a little. The fifth was back in Basel in 1901, established the JNF, Herzl report on his meeting with the Turkish Sultan, which also had accomplished nothing. There was so little progress that they decided not to meet in 1902. There's nothing that was happening. And yet Herzl persisted. He traveled across the world trying to drum up support for the Jewish homeland amongst Jews and non-Jews. And he persisted for reasons that are not entirely clear. He was single-minded in his obsession to relieve the plight of European Jews and find Jews a refuge. Why him, of all people, from his background? It just defies his history. There's so many other people like him who just completely disappeared. So I'll accept what Rav Aviner said, echoing Rav Kook, that Herzl was Shaliach Elokim L'Aurer Et Rayon HaTchiya Lumit. He was a divine agent to arouse the idea of the Jewish national renaissance. But the truth is, his life story is really inexplicable. Nothing was happening. Meanwhile, the situation in Europe was deteriorating. There are always pogroms that erupted in Europe. It was one of the catalysts for the great migration of Jews during this era that we'll discuss in a few weeks. And it always seemed tied into the Christian holidays, but we cannot underestimate the effect of the pogrom in Kishinev in April 1903, its effect on the Jews, on the world, and on the Zionist movement. Kishinev was the capital of Moldova, a city of 150,000 people, of whom a third were Jews, and the pogrom resulted from a fairly standard blood libel. A Ukrainian boy was found dead in February, a girl committed suicide, was pronounced dead in the Jewish hospital, and the Jews were accused of murdering both and using their blood to bake matzos. When the Christians exited church on Easter Sunday, April 19th, 1903, they began rioting, and they rioted for 3 days. Over the course of 3 days, 49 Jews were murdered, 100 seriously injured, hundreds of homes and businesses were looted, 2,000 families were left homeless, Sifrei Torah were destroyed, and most distressing to Jews, many Jewish women, wives and daughters, were forcibly raped. By the standard of brutality later in the 20th century, so this would barely register 49 Jews killed, but more were killed here than even in the pogroms in 1881. And the authorities did nothing. And everyone knew they did nothing, and worse, the bishop blessed the attackers. The prevailing rumor was that the Russian interior minister, head of the police, the rabid Jew-hating von Plehve, directed it. And the world had changed. The media changed the world. The New York Times reported the events. The Jewish and non-Jewish worlds erupted in fury, the first time such a thing happened. The Yiddish press in New York published lurid accounts of what was happening. The London Times a month later published a letter, turned out to be a forgery, but nonetheless a letter allegedly from von Plehve instructing the police to do nothing. The Zionists were in shock at the brutality. Bialik wrote his famous poems, Ala Shchita, on the slaughter. Ad Masai, Ad Ono, Ad Masai, until when? Until where? And Be'ir HaHarega, very powerful poem in the city of the slaughter, in which he described the butchery in graphic terms and in which he lambasted the Jews for their passivity and lack of self-defense. It's difficult to read. He blasts men for hiding in closets while their wives and daughters are being raped. To the hour of my sorrow, to the moment of my shame, Bialik wrote. It really was a turning point in Jewish history. Because after Kishinev, Herzl redoubled his efforts and focused on some short-term success. They had to show some accomplishment. See, he'd already been negotiating with the British for a tract of land near El Arish, in the Sinai, or in Egypt, or in Cyprus, anywhere. But in May of 1903, just a month after the pogrom, the British colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, having the father of Neville Chamberlain, who we'll encounter also later in the year, Chamberlain proposed to the Zionist representative Leopold Greenberg that the Jews accept land in East Africa sufficient for 1 million souls. It will be almost 2 months until Chamberlain made the offer directly to Herzl, but Herzl was at first not interested. It could be an additional site to Israel, but not the first. But when all the other plans fell through, he warmed to the idea of East Africa, and he wrote to Lord Nathaniel Rothschild on May 30th that he, Herzl, has a plan, and quote, "a very powerful man is ready to help me," meaning Chamberlain. So he'd heard, Herzl did, widespread reports of the despair that had swept Russian Jewry, that was the largest Jewish community, and one that would provide the bulk of the Zionists needed to settle the Jewish homeland wherever it was, and the people felt lost. This region, East Africa, Herzl was told, was warm on the coast. It's on the Indian Ocean, part of Kenya. It was cool in the interior, good for Europeans, and Jews could raise sugar and cotton there, what Jews always wanted to do. The charter was prepared by David Lloyd George's company. He was then a member of parliament. He'd be the prime minister and instrumental in the Balfour Declaration. The settlement was to be called New Palestine and was the British road for the encouragement of the Jewish national idea. Meanwhile, in early August, Herzl traveled to Russia to try to enlist the Tsar's support for the Zionist cause, meeting with von Pleva, among others. So it was a symmetry of sorts that Herzl saw. Herzl wanted the Jews out of Russia, and the Tsar wanted the Jews out of Russia. So there's a meeting of the minds. Why couldn't they work it out? It was because the Russians were unwilling to ignite any nationalist feeling amongst any of the ethnic groups in Russia, and therefore Herzl left disappointed. He was even criticized by leading Jews for meeting with von Pleva, who was now notorious for his role in the Kishinev massacre. But that's from the official Jews. Still, the ordinary Jews adulated Herzl wherever he met them and addressed them. Like on this trip to Vilna, he was greeted like a king and said, "Hamelech Herzl," they greeted him. When the 6th Zionist Congress convened in Basel a few weeks later, the Russian Zionists criticized Herzl's move. But when he informed them, when he came to the to try to see the Tsar, but when he informed the Action Committee of the formal British offer, I quote, "The British entertain this as any well-considered scheme aimed at the amelioration of the position of the Jewish race," and he proposed East Africa, the initial reaction was mixed. It was more stunned than antagonistic. But it was mixed. There were many positive reactions. Yechiel Shlenov, for example, a Russian Zionist leader, stood up and spontaneously recited Shechayanu. Not that they were so excited about Uganda, but because it was the first time a major power, Britain, had officially committed to finding a homeland for the persecuted Jews outside the cauldron of Europe. That itself, he felt, was worth a Shechayanu. On Sunday, August 23, 1903, Herzl presented the plan to the entire Congress. For most of the 572 delegates, it was the first they'd heard about it, and most were shocked. Herzl emphasized that Uganda could never replace Zion, and his chief aide, Dr. Max Nordau, termed Uganda a Nachteisel,
not Basel, a night shelter, a temporary refuge until the land of Israel could be secured, a refuge for European, especially Russian, Jewry that would face only more Kishinevs potentially in the future. Herzl's proposal was simple, to send an investigatory commission to East Africa to explore whether that territory was suitable for Jewish settlement. It wasn't to adopt Uganda as the new Jewish homeland, but rather whether or not to use it as a safe haven until the Zionist dream could be fully realized. There was a certain logic to it. Jews in Eastern Europe were suffering in dire poverty and worse discrimination, rampant persecution, pogroms, attacks. Britain had already begun restricting Jewish immigration, as you heard. That's why they even proposed this plan, the East Africa plan. They didn't want more Jews coming to Britain. And who knew for how much longer the United States would keep open its doors? It turned out another 15 years or so, and then the doors were more or less closed. The arguments against it were equally powerful. Jews could never and would never settle in Africa. The land was not suitable even as a refuge for large numbers of Jews. More importantly, efforts to establish the base in Uganda would divert precious resources, which were minuscule to begin with, and detract from the efforts to secure Eretz Israel. In fact, that's a very cogent argument. If they spent all their time and money now raising funds to develop East Africa and spend money on bringing Jews from Europe to East Africa, with what money will they have to spend on actually building a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel? And the return to Zion had a very romantic, certainly religious connotation. Africa? Not. People would be deflated. People now already primed. It's almost a little less than 10 years, 8 years or so, since these ideas started to percolate. The Zionist cause would suffer, and the Zionist organization's Basel program spoke only of a return to Zion. They had no mandate even to seek another place. And so their proposal was in stark contrast to the Balfour program, the platform. In the hall in Basel, today it's a casino. We saw it over a year ago. It still exists. Pandemonium broke out. It was like a shul meeting where they suggested raising the dues. People were shouting. People were banging chairs. Everyone knew the decision was significant in many ways. Chaim Weizmann, who saw himself as a rival of Herzl and was most critical of Herzl's meetings in St. Petersburg with the Russian government, was for the plan before he was against the plan. He first agreed to it with modifications, but then led the opposition to it. The cultural Zionists were naturally completely opposed, because to them Eretz Yisrael was the center of the Renaissance they foresaw, as were the practical Zionists, like Weizmann, who wanted to focus on settlement in the land of Israel, not settlement elsewhere. The Mizrahi, led by Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, supported Herzl. So intent were they on saving Jewish lives. That was the priority. To get Jews out of Russia, away from the Tsar, as quickly as possible, that was pikuach nefesh. So he voted for it. If Uganda was the exit out of the Russian inferno, so be it. And of course, Reines held as well, it was important that the movement not be split. And the movement was in grave danger of splitting to two, which basically would have ended it. Nevertheless, Rav Meir of Berlin, you know him better as Rav Meir Bar Ilan, the son of the Netziv, was another religious Zionist, but he voted against it for all the reasons we outlined. The socialists also supported Herzl. Why not? They could establish their socialist paradise anywhere, and Uganda would be a good training ground for the future. The opposition to Herzl was bitter, livid. Most of the Russian delegates opposed the plan, which was designed to help them, including those from Kishinev. The delegates from Kishinev, where the pogrom had just taken place a few months earlier, they opposed the Uganda plan. Within the Weizmann family, some voted for, some voted against. It's a tremendous split in the Jewish world. On Wednesday, August 26th, The vote was taken and Herzl won. The vote was close in a sense. He won a plurality. 292 in favor, 176 against, with 143 abstentions. You add the abstentions to those against, so it's more than Herzl got. Herzl staked his personal prestige on the vote, thus the large number of abstentions, and he was duly authorized to form an exploratory committee to send to East Africa. It almost never happened. Immediately after the vote, hundreds of delegates stormed out of the hall in protest, riots in the streets. The Zionist movement, not even a decade old, was on the verge of collapse. Herzl called everyone to order, invited those who left back the next day. They returned. They said their walkout was not anti-Herzl, but was a spontaneous demonstration of spiritual shock that the land of Israel had been abandoned. Herzl, it's a dramatic moment in Jewish history, took the podium, raised his right hand, and declared in Hebrew, "In Meshkachech Yerushalayim Meshkach Yemini," and that seemed to calm the crowd. A semblance of unity was restored, but Herzl knew that either the plan or the movement was dead. The opponents rallied in Basel, Weizmann, Mayor Dizengoff, Menachem Scheinkin, all now familiar Tel Aviv names, and they increased their efforts to build facts on the ground. In fact, it was after the Congress they announced they, despite the decision, they did not feel themselves bound by it, even though they were a minority. The leader of the Russian Zionists, Menachem Ussishkin, had not been at the Congress. He refused to countenance it. A few months later, it was December 1903, someone took a shot at Max Nordau, tried to kill him, and missed because Nordau was Herzl's aide. The plan was dead, in effect. The Zionist movement, though, was still alive, but within a year, Herzl was dead. July 3, 1904, at the tender age of 44. Herzl continued to travel in his last year, despite his ill health, meeting with world leaders, trying to heal the rift. In an April conference that just degenerated into the old arguments from the previous August. So although a commission was formed, actually, it didn't journey to East Africa until 1905, the year after Herzl's death. Soon after, the Seventh Zionist Congress officially rejected the Uganda plan, and the Zionist movement was back on track. So ask yourselves, we'll do this every week, how would you have voted had you been a delegate to the Sixth Zionist Congress? Would you vote to explore the possibility of a temporary asylum for Jews? Or stick to the pursuit of the Jewish homeland, being established only in the Jewish homeland and in no other place? Not an easy decision. I'm tempted to take a show of hands. I won't. The two most intriguing, tantalizing and infuriating words in life, and certainly in history, are what if. What if? What if they had adopted the Uganda plan? And what if East Africa had been established in the first decade of the 20th century as a Jewish homeland? So what would have been the fate of European Jewry, which suffered inordinately during World War I, had a million or so Jews gone to live in East Africa? Had it been known that Jews could have autonomy in that region, the effects of the war would have been different. The suffering endured by Jews in the early years of Soviet communism would have been ameliorated. The world itself could have warmed to the idea of Jewish nationhood, which is still a tough sell. Not to mention, even projecting a few decades later, European Jewry tertiated in World War II during the Holocaust. What might have been different? In fact, they adopted the plan, and a million Jews gone there, or more? Of course, such a plan might very well have sounded a death knell for Shivat Zion, because the funds raised for East Africa would not have existed to pursue the Jewish state in Israel. Most likely, even the East Africa plan would not have succeeded, because the Zionist movement would have split, lost any influence it had on foreign governments, and forfeited the resources provided to them by much of world Jewry. And who's to say that Jews in large numbers would have immigrated to East Africa anyway, and if had been established, so instead of the Arabs trying to drive the Jews out of Israel for 100 years, we would have the Africans trying to drive the Jews out of Africa now for 100 years. It was a price to be paid for the acceptance of the plan and its rejection of the plan. The price was short term, but the benefits were long term, and the benefits are all a reminder to us of the Gemara Brachos Daf Hey Amud Aleph, one of the three things that are acquired with suffering, Miknes B'Yisurin, is Eretz Yisrael. The land of Israel is only acquired with suffering. As we well know, the decision had ramifications for decades, even down to today, changed Jewish history. If we look back, likely we're the beneficiary, but we'll never know for sure. I thank you for coming. Next week we'll look at the Balfour Declaration, try to get the toolbar off the screen also. Thank you very much.